It's another soundtrack in live this week, this time recorded a month or so back at Festival No. 6 in the weird and wonderful village of Portmeirion in North Wales. My guest that day was a novelist, playwright and occasional director of shorts who well and truly thrust himself into the pop cultural consciousness with Trainspotting and Danny Boyle's subsequent film adaptation of the same name. I am, of course, talking about Irvine Welsh. Irvine was in fine form discussing everything from his unlikely love of musicals and rom-coms to the directors and composers who've inspired him as both a writer and a great fan of cinema. It all seemed to go down very well with a packed audience thanks to those who attended, which made a very long round trip more than worthwhile. Indeed, we love getting out and about on soundtracking, as do the team at No Such Thing as a Fish. And if you've ever listened to the hit podcast from the researchers behind the BBC show QI, you'll also know that nobody's better at sniffing out implausible yet hilarious facts than they. And now they've written a book. It's called The Book of the Year 2018 and is full of odd, funny, yet completely true stories from the year. For instance, turns out Elon Musk released a product that throws flames up to 10 feet and called it not a flamethrower. Fact. Elsewhere, priests stopped praying for people in case they breached new data protection laws by doing so. It really is great fun, even if you haven't come across either QI or the podcast. And if that is the case, well, you need to rectify that situation immediately. The Book of the Year 2018 by No Such Thing as a Fish is your definitive guide to the world's weirdest news and is out now in audiobook, ebook, and hardback in all good bookshops. And so to Irvine, whose books, it's fair to say, are rather more lurid and sweary, rather like our conversation. You have been warned. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming in. We've never done this before at a festival, so this is our first one, so I'm slightly terrified, but really excited about who we're going to be chatting to. I've tried to get some bits that we can play so it's not just a kind of straightforward chat, which is how I record the podcast. We never plan stuff in advance, but I wanted to try and be able to play some music for you today. So what I've done is I got in touch with Irvine, asked him to pick some of his favourite films and some of the music from those. So we got some of that to play you throughout the conversation. But without further ado, please welcome to our first ever festival recording of soundtrack and the fabulous Mr. Hold on, I've got his walk-on music ready, Irvine Welsh. She loves you, yeah. Was that a good choice?
It was a fantastic choice. I felt this audience was going to be so sexy that I had to put a dark glasses on to blind myself. But I'm ready to face you all now, like, you know, and be overwhelmed by the sheer beauty of you all.
That's one of the earliest tracks you remember hearing, is that right?
Yeah, my mum and dad were big Beatles fans, and I kind of grew up with the Beatles, really. And I think as you do when you're that age, I kind of I rebelled against them. You know, how can you rebel against the Beatles, basically? You're kind of rebelling against life itself, in a way. Maybe that explains a lot of things, actually. Yeah, and I kind of thought, oh, fuck the Beatles, you know? It's like kind of... And I went to that phase, you know, when I got into punk and all that. I was like, yeah, this is great. Fuck all these bands and all that. It was only later on that I kind of really started to appreciate the Beatles. I mean, I did, obviously, as a kid. You jump around to the early Beatles and all that.
Yeah.
But when they get to that point, you know, when they start to get that kind of mystical way. They had all these different kind of eras. And it's amazing, the thing about the Beatles is this all took place in 7 years, basically.
Crazy.
It's absolutely nuts, yeah.
What was the first memory that you have of music within film connecting with you? And the music being as important as what you were seeing and the story you were being told?
Oliver, when it transferred from stage to screen, yeah. You know, it was kind of like Lionel Bart's original score on the... on the stage, and it, I remember going to Blackpool as a kid on holiday. I think we were there for 10 days, and I saw the film 8 times. I just kind of broke ranks from everybody and just said, I'm off to the cinema, just give me a couple of bobs so I can go back to the cinema. And they were happy, you know, just get them out of the fucking road for a couple of hours, like...
What do you think it was about the story and the music, obviously?
It's funny because Dickens is quite a bleak writer. It's a very bleak subject matter about basically a kid kind of going into the care system and then being on the streets and getting taken up by a bunch of criminals and trained as a criminal. But the music lifts it into this kind of sort of romantic kind of kitsch, basically. And I think that, you know, it's probably a big influence on me kind of underscoring my kind of whole view of life and my whole view of kind of street life and social life, that no matter how dark things are, there's always an underlying song kind of waiting to burst out.
Musicals in general, are you a fan of, or is it just that one?
No, I do like musicals, and it's a terrible thing to kind of admit.
Why?
Well, musicals make me cry. I have to watch White Christmas every single year. The ritual is that, you know, it's like I put White Christmas on, and the bit at the end where the general comes in and inspects the troops, I mean, I just cry. You know, it's just like just sitting there, tears streaming down my eyes, and I can watch anything on the screen. I can watch the most excessive violence. I just laugh. You know, I think this is just actors and special effects and prosthetics being shot off. But when I see somebody expressing genuine kind of emotion, pathos, kind of sadness and love, I just kind of, I just turn into a big sap. Cheesy kind of romantic comedy, you can sit there and can watch it, and I think it's a different thing where women like going to rom-coms and all that, and they go and, you know, you go on dates to romantic comedies, the women always kind of sit there and go you know, and you know, and then it's like, you know, it's like, and I was sitting there just welling up, just about to kind of, you know, fighting back the tears, you know, I've got to toughen up here, again, you know, if it's like people getting blown off, did I say? Yeah,
different type of film, Roman, different Freud. Type of film.
First Freudian slip of the day. People losing limbs and all that, and suspense stuff, and I just sit there and kind of, you know, if you're sitting with your wife or girlfriend or whatever, it's like they're just like kind of, but the romantic comedy, they're like, fuck this, piss, this is fucking nonsense.
Sobbing your eyes out. What was the last film you cried at then?
I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Have you seen Mamma Mia 2 yet?
I've not seen Mamma Mia 2.
Oh,
no.
I'm warning you.
I loved Mamma Mia 1 just for Pierce Brosnan singing SOS. It was the most incredible thing ever. It was such a kind of, you know, an un-SOS type vocal there. Yeah. It was like a JK staggering down the hill, like, trying to get him.
For those non-Scots, that's a homeless person on the street corner. I tried to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood.
It used to be so nice, it used to be so good.
You picked some great films when I got in touch with you and asked you to pick some of the favourite films that music's a really big part. And one of them features the music of a really good friend of yours, Clint Mansell, who is an incredible composer that we've been lucky enough to have on the podcast and stuff. What is it about Clint's music that you love and him as well, about his work?
Yeah, I mean, I was a kind of... I've been a friend of Clint's for a long time, and I was a kind of big fan of Pop Elite itself, a very underrated band, I thought. And I've worked with Clint as well, you know, and he's like, he's not frightened to use big emotions when it's important to advance the piece. He's not frightened to use a bit of restraint and let the piece talk for itself. He's one of these guys, he's not got any ego at all. He's just a really lovely, kind of down-to-earth guy. And everything that he does is in service of the movie. You know, if he thinks that certain parts of the movie are dragging, he'll do something to push it on, like the Requiem for a Dream score. He had that duru duru duru. If you think about that, that was quite a depressing and kind of slow-moving film, you know. And that track just pushed the whole thing right on, like. But when we were working together in Filth, it was the opposite. He kind of felt that McAvoy was doing this very high-energy performance, so Clinton wanted to keep it quite kind of muted and in the background, and just adding little kind of little layers of emotional complexity to it, but without swamping it and or trying to push it in that way.
Is it important for you to be involved in your projects when they get taken that far, working with John S. Baird, who directed Filth, which was brilliant, I loved it. Is it important for you to try and be involved to see your work right through to the end?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really, I think you've got to, it depends on the relationship you have with the filmmakers, and I've always had good relationships with them. And, you know, the best ones are kind of natural collaborators, you know, like John and Danny Boyle and... Paul McGuigan, you know, they want you to be involved in what they're doing. I think ultimately you have to kind of see it as a very different thing. I always think you can't stand over somebody's shoulder, you know, because it's like when I'm writing the book, I don't want somebody standing over my shoulder tell me what to do, you know. So you have to give other people the same respect, and you have to let people. Ultimately, the excitement is, it's all about transformation. The excitement's in the transformation, basically. I don't want a kind of photostat copy of what I've already done, you know, that'd be boring. So you're looking for people to bring something to it, and you're looking for them to kind of, if they've got a really strong vision for it, you just stand back and let them go on with it. If they kind of think they want you to help them formulate that kind of vision of how it should be, then you get involved. But you've got to kind of gauge what they want to do.
When you're writing, do you use music to help you with the characters?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I make a playlist for every character, and I make a playlist for every book. There's a thematic overview, and then there's also what, you know, devising a playlist for what the character was kind of listening to at the time. It's quite in my office when I do the first draft. I've got the standing up desk, so I'm typing at the standing up desk. I've got the Pioneer mixer and CDJs next to me. So I'm kind of going from one to the other quite a lot. So it feels very kind of interactive.
Basically. DJing, writing at the same time.
Yeah, no, just kind of doing, putting some tracks down to get me in the mood, and then going back into the text again, and then going back into the tracks and getting. I think it's really helpful to me in the drawing up of characters. It's like I like to have characters that are so kind of in your face and fully drawn that you can actually. You actually hear their breath on your ear in the pub when they're berating you and all that. I like to get that kind of immediacy in them, and I think that music's one of the ways you do that. You know, you find you think, what would this character be passionate about? And it's funny because you always think that you're really cool and you've got great musical tastes, and then you realise it's just a disease of association. Basically, you're just lucky enough to have a cool big sister or big cousin or, you know, who's got a great record collection, and you kind of absorb a lot of that. When I wrote Filth, I thought, I can't just pick records I like for Bruce Robertson. I've got to pick records that I don't like, you know. So I picked, a lot of kind of kitschy and country and western stuff, which I never really got, and a lot of kind of sort of kind of heavy metal, kind of sort of white supremacist male heavy metal stuff, mm-hmm. which I never really sort of dug either. And cheesy power ballads.
That's a mix.
And that's what Bruce Robertson would listen to. And of course he is. He's a jambo. He's going to listen to Shite, isn't he?
In the middle of that playlist as well, it's got H-E-A-R-T-S right in the middle of it, to keep him happy.
So you get that kind of track, and it's like, listen to all these songs. I actually started enjoying them. You know, I thought, fuck me. These are actually pretty brilliant in a Shite way. It's a disease of immersion, really.
Did that start with Trainspotting? Were you doing that way back then as well?
With Trainspotting, I was obsessed with Acid House and raving and all that, and I wanted to kind of, I wanted to get the kind of energy that came from that scene, trying to try and capture it on the page, even though it wasn't particularly about kind of that house kind of thing, and I wanted to get a kind of 4/4 beat into the pages, make them turn on a 4/4 beat. And that's why I went into using the Scottish vernacular, because it's performative, you know, so it's a performative thing. So it's got that kind of, like rap comes from flighting, which is Highlanders' kind of way of settling disputes. So they're kind of rapping things out anyway, and they're performing. And to try and get that kind of beat to it was really important. And also, you know, the other thing about... But house music was all the effects on top of it, you know. So the effects would be typographical things on the page that broke up that kind of beat. So I was trying to kind of consciously layer these things in that way, particularly in the early books.
When you have characters that, you know, throughout your career you've written about at different stages, and most recently in Dead Men's Trousers, which is brilliant, it's such a great read, and you kind of miss those characters, and it's so great to see where they are now. Is it different playlists? So you almost kind of like, well, what's Begbie listening to now? What's Renton listening to now?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have Begbie listening to Slade and Mott the Hoople. You know, he had to move on, basically.
Just in
so
private.
I remember I was on this plane one time, and I was just going through all this different stuff, and I heard Guns N' Roses' Chinese Democracy, which is actually just a kind of Axl Rose overproduced studio album, like, you know. And at first I was thinking, this is absolutely fucking terrible. And then I kept playing it and playing it. I thought, Begbie would love this, like, you know. And why would he like it, you know? And I'm saying, well, it's like kind of, he wouldn't see it as overproduced. He would see it as using the technology of the time, basically. So it's, you know, it's fundamentally about a kind of reinvention. And he was about a kind of reinvention of the self, in a very sort of facile kind of way, but superficial way. So I thought, this is a perfect thing he would be into. He wouldn't be into the original Guns N' Roses, but he would be into Chinese Democracy. And he would be arguing very vociferously that it was the best thing he'd ever done.
Sitting in a Chinese stew to view my dear sins.
Another thing I thought of is Mahler. You know, he's got this dual personality of this psychopathic bam and also this kind of poncy artist who needs to relax. I thought in his downtime he'd be sitting back on the couch with Mahler, kind of Mahler's kind of light strings kind of massaging his temples and all that as he kind of tried to calm down and get his breathing regulated.
With Trainspotting, when it got, you know, taken onto the big screen, and what Danny did with that, and with the second one as well, music was such a massive part. What was your reaction to the music that was used within the film?
We didn't have any money. I think the whole thing was shot on, you know, probably less than £1 million. I mean, it would cost you that to license all this stuff now. I mean, it's like the Trainspotting 2, we had to go through that, down that licensing route, and it's like Universal that own most of the music rights. So you kind of have to end up dealing with them. But we didn't have the money in the first one, so we basically called in favours with people that we knew. I used to kind of hang around the Fortress Studios in Clerkenwell. My pal Steve Malloy had a cafe bar in there, and that was the rehearsal rooms for all the Britpop bands, basically. So we kind of got to know all them, and Danny had worked with Underworld and Left Field on Shallow Grave. So basically calling in favours, getting the musicians to donate tracks that we couldn't afford to license. We had a private screening for them, and remember, like, Carol and Rick from Underworld came there, and we're trying to convince them that it wasn't about people getting fucked up. It was a movie about the vitality of youth, which I think it is, basically, like, you know. And, you know, the fucked upness is incidental to it. So they kind of, you know, it was like they had a whole different reaction to it when they saw the film. And everybody did, and they all wanted to be involved, you know. And they all told their friends, and their friends wanted to be involved and started sending demos in and started to see if they could get screenings. So it kind of kicked off in that way. And I think that Danny put it together really, really well, because to have really good tracks is one thing, but to fit all these things together without a score, you know, it's basically just track after track after track. But I think it was an absolutely fantastic achievement.
it's interesting as well because like Lust for Life was obviously a big song before the film, but now whenever, well, I don't know, I'm sure some of you might feel the same, but whenever I hear that song now, all I can see is that scene in the film. You know, they've become this marriage now as well, which is kind of power to the choice of that track, but also how good the film was.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing because Iggy Pop's a neighbour of mine in Miami and he's become a good friend over the years. You know, and I kind of completely idolised that guy, and I've actually still got a poster of him on my wall. And I think I can't have him round to my house because he's going to see the fucking poster, like, you know. And it's going to seem a bit sad and stocky and wanky now, like, you know. Because, I'm going to swing by yours. No, I'll come by yours, mate. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You've got a nicer pad than me. But so it's like I can't take it down, but I can't allow him in my house until it's taken down.
About Quadrophenia in that film.
Yeah, there's an interesting connection with Trainspotting there because Brian Tofano was a cinematographer on both, who's kind of one of the most fucking amazing guys you're ever going to meet. And Brian was kind of, he was getting on a bit with when he was doing Trainspotting, but he would do all these incredible physical contortions to get the shot that he wanted, like, you know, incredibly athletic guy in a strange way, you know, and he just was a complete perfectionist. And the interesting thing about Trainspotting and the interesting thing about Quadrophenia is that if you freeze every single still from, if you take every single still from that movie, it's like a poster. And Quadrophenia is like that as well. Everything, every shot is so beautifully composed in these movies. There is a kind of continuity in a way of feel between Quadrophenia and Trainspotting. And that's to do with Brian.
And the way that the music was used as well. I've gone with the track from the closing scene.
You were under the impression that when you were walking forwards that you'd end up further onward. But things ain't quite that simple. You got altered in. You were told to not take chances. You missed out on new dances. Now you're losing all your dimples. My jacket's gonna be cut slim and check. Maybe a touch of seer sucker with an open neck. I ride a G.
It's that kind of brilliant statement about sort of about London at that time, basically. And I mean, I was, you know, I kind of used to go down to London from a very early age because my auntie and uncle stayed down there. And my mum and dad, you're noticing the Oliver theme recurring here. They were anxious to get me the fuck out the road for the school holidays, basically. Send them down there. And so I kind of got into London and being in London from quite an early age. And I moved down there when I was 16. And there was that kind of vibe about it then. It was just that kind of end of that whole Carnaby Street-ish type era, you know, that sort of the tail end of the kind of first kind of big kind of wave of mod that just percolated right through into the culture. And it kind of, you know, it resurfaced in punk with Paul Weller and all that sort of stuff. And it just, it kind of captured that whole sensibility of it. You know, I remember my big cousin Alec was a kind of total kind of sort of London mod. You know, he's 10 years older than me, and I just kind of completely looked up to this guy. You know, he was like a kind of David Hemmings type character, you know. And he always used to come in with kind of like London dolly birds, basically. And I would be sitting there like kind of sort of this 14-year-old covered in spots, kind of thinking, fucking hell, you bastard. I want to be you, you know.
It's, you were in a band, though, when you came down to London, you know? You played bass and you sung in bands, other bands. Is that not right?
Yeah, I mean, I did mess around in bands for a bit. And like all bassists, I was a failed guitarist until I finally became a failed bassist. You know, it's like one of the record shops on Inverness Street in Camden. You know, you used to have all these adverts like Drummer Wanted and all that. I was just browsing around, and I used to spend all my time browsing in record shops. And I saw this kind of card, you know, like kind of bassist wanted. And I was kind of looking, and I thought, yeah. You know. And I recognised the phone number. Oh. I recognised it as my mate Dave's fucking number, the guitarist in the band.
No!
And he goes, so I went round the phone box and I phoned them up and I went, all right, mate, I saw the advert in the paper, what's going on then? Bassist? Yeah. He goes, yeah, the we've got is fucking useless. He goes, you fucking wanker. So that was like, I was going to tell you, mate, I was going to tell you, it ain't working out. You know, so that I realised that I was never going to kind of make it, basically, at that time. It was a kind of recurring theme that I could never keep time with the drummer, and every time that a band got reasonably competent, you know, because in the punk era, nobody could play anything. But everybody else seemed to progress at a greater rate than me. And it was just some kind of lack of coordination going on, internal coordination going on, some kind of on-the-spectrum kind of behaviour on my part that I just didn't match up the dots as quick as everybody else, unfortunately.
What about writing lyrics?
That's really how the writing came about. You know, it was like I realised that I was writing a lot of ballads, basically, and, you know, ballads are just stories. You know, they're kind of set to song. I thought, well, obviously the song's not working out, so maybe just stick to the stories.
I'm going to play this from a film. Some of you will recognise it.
He will rock you. He will roll you. Baby, don't you know? My he will move your soul. Come on, love me today, love me tomorrow, all day, all night, you feel my heat, feel my heat. I think we should repeat that again. Feel my heat.
Feel my heat.
Yeah, it's definitely cool. Let's lay it down.
Boogie Nights, Mark Wahlberg and John C. Reilly in that clip. It's what a film. What
amazing
a film.
Movie, yeah.
I mean, the music in that is just... I could have picked so many tracks. This is another one that I picked. What is it about the film and the music about that film that you really liked?
You know what, the I always think like kind of anything you do sort of kind of artistically, whether it's kind of a song, a book, a film, do it with fucking exuberance, mm-hmm. You know. It doesn't matter, you know, it's like because so many people are talented and are technically good, but they're miserable fuckers. You don't want to spend any time in the company of miserable people. So anything you should do should be powered by some kind of exuberance, even if the material is quite dark or you want to explore quite kind of darker issues. So, have a bit of kind of exuberance and fun about it. And that film is kind of, is very, very kind of bleak in a lot of ways, You know, like every film, like Trainspotting, you know, so all these kind of movies are all like kind of, whoa, this is an adventure, we're in a whole different place, and then the dream turns sour in the second part of it, and we come to some kind of understanding of life at the end of it, like in some way, you know, they're all that kind of sort of roller coaster thing. But this is done with such verve, and it's done with such kind of excitement, and such kind of, such belief in unraveling that world. I mean, this is a, you know, the whole San Fernando Valley kind of pornography thing. It's a parallel universe to the whole Hollywood kind of system in LA, and there isn't really that much crossover between the two, you know? Yeah, I mean, I got the private films kind of to do the pornography, kind of the big porn guys in Europe, where they were at the time. They had a boat in Cannes, and everybody wanted to get onto the party, and I managed to get onto the boat, and it was great, you know, because there was like, they had these Swedish bouncers, and they had this kind of somehow this kind of pickpocket gang got onto the boat, and they started running amok. I was downstairs and I kind of missed all this, but the porn stars were all having this big party downstairs, and Swedish bouncers are absolutely fucking useless, by the way. The Swedish bouncers got kind of turned over by the kind of the band of thieves, and there was carnage upstairs. And one of the porn actors opened the door and he saw this. He just locked the door. Because we're going to just party here until it is all over. Yeah. So we did. It was great, like, you know. And one of the guys had this private kind of laminates with actor, with performer. On. And I says, you've got to give me that, mate, because I want to walk down Leith Walk with fucking private performer. Like, you know? And he did as well. Like, you know? So I treasure it to this day.
When you were talking earlier about, you know, stood up there typing in your CDJs to one side, what's forming the choice of songs that you're deciding to put on those playlists?
I think you kind of, there's an interface between the you know, the character and the theme, and also what you kind of, and the kind of energy levels of that. You know, there's something like a character that you want kind of intuitively suggests a sort of certain playlist, you know, and you just kind of mess around with the songs until you kind of, and you switch from one to the other, you switch from character back to playlist, and one informs the, you know, one, and one informs the other. Almost like a three, you know, they start to become three-dimensional then. If you go out with a bunch of people and you have a few drinks and there's a jukebox in the corner, you get competitive over the jukebox after a while. Like, and you see it a lot if you have people back and you've got, you know, you're DJing and people are putting tracks on, people get really fucking competitive and all that. And you see there's almost a visceral edge that comes out, and this is, I'm imposing my fucking will on you. You know, I'm imposing my taste on you. And that's when you see people in the raw. And I'm trying to get to that. You know, you try to get down to maybe five or six essential tracks that are just going to really, that they're going to fight and kill for to hear, basically.
One of the tracks that I wanted to play was from a gentleman who crosses so many different, he's a writer, he's a director, he's a composer, John Carpenter.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean, I know it's kind of quite unfashionable to say, but I mean, I think John Carpenter is a genius, and he will be regarded, I think, in the same way as Alfred Hitchcock is now, as a master of suspense. And because Hitchcock comes from the golden era of Hollywood, and it's like, oh, you know, it's like kind of it's seen as a much more naive and sort of simple place, and Carpenter comes from the kind of bit where everything was sort of, it became mass entertainment and genreized, and it was kind of about pushing buttons and to get visceral reactions from the audience. It's seen as more cynical, but Carpenter is like a genuine auteur. You know, he takes the whole movie and he puts his stamp on the whole thing. He's done some incredible scores, and the way he does them, he's just sitting there with a little kind of keyboard, kind of sort of tapping away as his film that he shot is playing. Assault on Precinct 13 is absolutely amazing.
favourite John Carpenter film?
I mean, you kind of, you know, you go for the big ones like Halloween, you know, the kind of when he's, you know, when he's really, he's building tension and he just does it so well, you know. He's like kind of, and I just love, you know, it's like, I love the way that he kind of just keeps making movies. Like, you know, he's obviously, you know, he's, maybe his biggest creative years have passed him, but he just keeps knocking them out and he just, you know, he obviously just loves what he's doing.
What about for you as a filmmaker? Is that something you want to take further? You've made films?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what I find is that I kind of like doing short films and videos. I've not got the patience to deal with actors in a long-term basis. Like, you know, 8 weeks on a fucking set with a bunch of actors. Fuck that for a laugh. Like, you know, because the thing about actors is they all come to you with the problems on set, you know, and it's like, most of the time, it's just because they're nervous. Because anything an actor does on film, it's there forever. So they're shit scared by the time they go. You know, they're shit scared they're going to make a tit of themselves, or they're not going to look good, or they're going to fuck things up. They do all sorts of things, like they ask for more lines, you know, or they kind of they start focusing on their part to the kind of detriment of how it fits into the film in a whole, as a whole, and they just need to be kind of reassured. And they always ask for fucking money. As well, like, you know, they always ask for money and expenses and for this or that or different, you know. And it's like, it's not really what they're interested in. It's just a way of trying to get attention, you know. And I remember, like, when I was directing, I think it was a film for TV, and I was quite edgy about it. And I said to Danny Boyle, I said, you got any tips for me, Danny? I've got, you know, he says, just tell them anything. Tell actors anything. You know, just to get them to shoot the scene. And then after they've shot the scene, tell them I've done a great job and they'll forget about everything they said before. You know, and it's true.
Pulp Fiction. Are you a big Tarantino fan?
Not a kind of unequivocal or uncritical one, but mm-hmm. I mean, he shot a real bit of verve and adrenaline into sort of Hollywood, basically. And I've got a kind of personal reason to like him as well, because we're going to do this screening of Trainspotting at the Music Box Cinema in Chicago, and they've got this beautiful kind of 35mm projector system sorted out, you know, and nobody could find a 35mm kind of version of Trainspotting. You know, we thought we were going to have to send over to the UK, package it out there, and it would cost money and all that. And somebody said, well, Quentin Tarantino will have one, because he collects everything to do with film, like, you know. And straight away, you know, got in touch with him, and straight away, he sent his own personal 35mm copy of Trainspotting to the to the Music Box, which I thought was lovely. Like, you know, he just said, "This was a little post-it note on it, like, kind of remember to post this back." You know. So we posted it back to him, but it was great, and it was a nice gesture. But you know, the first few films kind of shot in this kind of real energy, and you know, as a writer, you kind of admire long chunks of dialogue in films. They almost brought back that kind of stylish film noir dialogue where you have the kind of wise-cracking guys and the trash-talking dames kind of sort of, you know, it harked back to that. It kind of integrated all that kind of stylization of the old Hollywood with a kind of very new and dark and kind of noirish sort of approach to it all. So, yeah, so it was, you know, these early films were fantastic. And the way this Pulp Fiction soundtrack is put together is absolutely amazing. The film has elevated songs that nobody else would kind of, you know, they would have been obscure, but they completely work in the context of that film And because they're associated with the film, they're kind of elevated as well now in people's consciousness. So it's just, again, it's like, it's sometimes, it's, you know, it doesn't need to be the best tune. It just needs to be the best tune for that particular scene.
I'm going to play one now, if that's all right.
Now, the moment you've all been waiting for, it's a world famous Jack Rabbit Slim's Twist Contest. Now let's meet our first contestants here this evening. Young lady, what is your name?
Mrs. Mia Wallace.
And how about your fella here?
Vincent Vega.
All right, let's see what you can do. Take it away.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, said the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
When you look at these dialogue kind of lines there, like kind of, Mia Wallace, and then, there's a Vega. Tarantino's obviously given the direction to kitsch this the fuck up. And not a lot of directors would have the balls to do that, but it completely works in that context. Like.
When you were a kid, though, going to the cinema, what were the films that you remember seeing when you were growing up?
Oh, the Bond films, all the time. Really? Connery's Bond. We used to go to the State Cinema and... They used to play the Bond films on a loop in cartoons, basically. Mm-hmm. So you'd go in there for the matinee, and you would sit there all day, just watch them, kind of watch them twice, even, like, you know. You just kind of, you know, it's like, kind of, you've never seen so many schemey kids in Leith totally fucking silent for about 3 hours, like, you know. That was my kind of, my kind of cinema education, and you kind of, like, it's just such a great thing for a kid that a bunch of you go around there, and you sit down, you get your wee ice cream, and you just sit and watch these movies. And, you know, it's like you're kind of completely lost in this world. You're taking out your own place. You know, you're sitting there in your kind of holy latex jeans, and there's kind of Sean Connery up there in a tuxedo. And you're thinking, that's going to be me one day.
Sad about Danny not doing the new Bond film, because I thought that was going to be really, really exciting, and I'd really quite like to see you write a Bond film.
I don't know. I mean, I think that John Hodge, who was going to do the screenplay for Danny, and I think they both wanted to push it out a bit, maybe further than the franchise was ready to take.
Yeah.
I think they were going to do a real kind of nut job treatment on it.
What's next? Do you make plans?
I think if you get up in the morning, you're doing okay, like, you know. But I'm not a great planner ahead, but just, you know, I've got loads of film and TV stuff, projects that are kind of inching towards completion, then two steps back, then inching towards completion again, as these things always are.
Irvin Welsh, everybody, thank you so much, sir, for your
time.
Thank you very much.
from Trainspotting, that's a final hit by Left Field, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking Live with novelist, playwright, director and top bloke, Irvin Welsh. My huge thanks to Irvin for taking the time to talk to us and to Festival Number 6 for having us. Sadly though, it's the last one for a while, but that didn't stop us having an absolute ball. Head to irvinwelsh.net meanwhile to find out what the man is up to at the minute. And if you've enjoyed this chat, you may also very well be interested in Simon Mayo's Book of the Year podcast. Their latest episode features author Heather Morris, whose debut novel, at the age of 65, is the international bestseller The Tattooist of Auschwitz. In future episodes, Simon will be joined by Anthony Horowitz, Ian Rankin and Lee Child, amongst many others. So do subscribe to Simon Mayo's Book of the Year on iTunes and Spotify for your literary fix. And if you haven't already, please do subscribe to us too. Rate us if you can on iTunes if you get a second. And to find us on socials, we're on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter at Soundtracking UK. And follow us on Spotify to get dedicated playlists for every show in which we list the tracks we play in the order they appear. Next up, two men who have appeared on the podcast previously, twice. In fact, Ben Wheatley was our first ever guest. For their third outing, they've done it together. Ben Wheatley and Clint Mansell next week, talking amongst many things about their new project together, Happy New Year, Colin Bursted. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.